Fair warning, this show contains strong language and adult themes from time to time. Sorry, Jerry can't help it.
Sick Boy Wolfgang Productions presents The Offering with Jerry Horror. A deep dive into the history of film and its filmmakers. Mostly horror, always genre.
RetroSource Long Island is taking you back. Take a trip back in time with their custom-built store paying tribute to the best decades of all time, the 80s and the 90s. They have a massive collection of video games to choose from, spanning from Atari 2600 to Nintendo Switch, not to mention a large selection of toys, plushies, art, collectibles, board games, and so much more. They've got a friendly and quirky staff that loves to talk to you all about your favorite movies, cartoons, and TV shows that you grew up with. Check out their funny skits on their Instagram at RetroSourceLI. Do you love E.T., Thundercats, Back to the Future, Masters of the Universe, RoboCop, Street Fighter, Knight Rider, Ninja Turtles, Pokemon, Power Rangers? Yeah, man, RetroSource has got you covered. Take a photo in their Saved by the Bell high school locker display. It's totally mint. Spend hours playing arcade games while getting a sugar rush from vintage candy and soda. It's gnarly, buddy. Located at 1075 Portion Road in Farmingville, New York, RetroSource, Long Island's most radical shopping experience. It's always Halloween at the Haunted House of Hamburgers, Long Island's only Halloween-themed restaurant. At Haunted House of Hamburgers, they are obsessed with both Halloween and hamburgers, so why not have the best of both worlds every day? Salivate over their delicious hamburgers during Boo Brunch, along with their Witch's Brew and Crypt Keeper cocktails. Or take a stab at the undead desserts, such as Ice Cream Sundaes, with your bobbing for apple pie. My favorites are the Afterlife Alcoholic Shakes. I'd go for the Pentagram Passion Fruit, or the Exorcism Espresso Martini Shake, or my go-to, the Loch Ness Monster Lobster Rolls. This place is fun as hell. They even encourage you to come dine in, dressed in costume. Your kids will love that. Or that could be one hell of a memorable first date. They're not going to forget that, right? Here's a little insider tip. For a far-out, trippy dining experience, ask your waiter for 3D glasses. It's pretty rad, let me tell you. Located at 330 Fulton Street in Farmingdale, New York, it's the restaurant that looks like a haunted house. You won't miss it, I promise. Make Haunted House of Hamburgers your year-round Halloween destination. Welcome to The Offering with Jerry Horror, the show where we can have a quiet and frank discussion as adults about the things that matter to me, or at least that I think matter to me. Please take a moment to subscribe to our show wherever you get fine podcasts, and hey, stay up to date on future episodes. Coming up, we're flashing back to the year 1986, when this actor was arguably the biggest star in the world. He would have a blank check to do whatever film his heart desired. He chose to go head-to-head with Top Gun via this quasi-slasher movie, one of the most expensive vanity projects ever made. Stay tuned, you're not going to want to miss this. Ladies and gentlemen and friends beyond the binary, welcome to season 3 of The Offering. It's so good to be back. I've missed you so much. I love doing this podcast. I'm passionate about what I do, and thank you. Thank you for joining me. I genuinely appreciate it. If I could, I'd write everybody a thank you note. Unfortunately, it would only take 20 minutes because nobody listens to this show. No, I'm just kidding. It would take like 25 minutes. Which is much longer than I can last in the sack. And everybody knows that. You know, it's out there. It's known information. So, listen, I had a really terrible tragedy in my life, and it hurt me. It messed me up. It's not easy. I'm still processing it. I'm still getting over it. One of my best friends in the whole world, Jeremy, he took his own life, and it was unexpected. No one saw it coming. I kept talking to him about maybe seeing a psychologist, maybe, you know, going to a psychiatrist. And I've always struggled with mental health issues. You know, it's part of the reason that you guys haven't heard from me A lot of the times I'm dealing with my own stuff and I feel like I'm turning a corner. I'm much better. And hopefully you can be better too. You know, it's never too late to go to talk to somebody and get some help. Discretionary, call 988 in the United States. If you need help, if you need someone to talk to, it's a great resource. Either text 988, call 988. So that's always there for you. That door is open. And if you need to walk through it, walk through it. But this season is dedicated to Jeremy. We went to the movies all the time. Every week. And when there wasn't something out, we would rent a movie on streaming. You know, we loved movies. And he was very passionate about that. He was very supportive about this podcast. You know, he would always tell me, he'd be like, this is what you're supposed to be doing. He's like, you got to talk to people about this stuff. This is, you know, this is what you feel in your heart. So this season is dedicated to Jeremy. And I want to tell you, even if you're in a dark place, it gets better. I promise. It's not worth destroying your life, your family's lives. Call 988 if you have trouble. There's somebody always there waiting to listen to you. It's a fantastic resource. Again, please, if you or anyone you know is suffering or going through a mental health crisis, it's never too late to get some help. So if I'm going to keep doing this, I'm doing it for old Jeremy and because I just love talking to you folks. I miss doing this. I love doing this. This is my passion. This is what I'm all about. A lot of people have been asking me, oh, today's movie is crazy, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. You're going to have to wait. We're edging to that. We'll get there. We'll get there. I promise. Largely, the podcast has been a horror podcast. We've done mostly horror movies. We've done some sci-fi, some genre stuff. Like last season, we did Bloodsport. This season is a little bit different. We're basically doing big swings and blockbusters that either worked or were complete flops. And I realized something. I realized that it's not about the genre. What it's about is chasing the stories. What is the story behind the story? And that is what intrigues me. That's what I've been chasing. And I can't stop because it's what fuels me. I love learning about this stuff. It's just incredible. You know, the behind the scenes stuff that you never knew. You know, you've watched these movies maybe dozens of times. And then you find out all this backstory stuff. And you're like, oh my God, it just blows your mind. My problem with the horror community right now is, especially within the podcast space, it's become a echo chamber. And it became one of those things like we were a little ahead of the curve with the first season where we started doing Scream movies and we were doing, you know, a lot of the Dimension stuff, the Weinstein stuff. And it just became like everybody's doing the same things. Even movies that I had planned for the season, I would be like, oh my God, like three other podcasts just did those movies. And I'm like, it becomes one of these things. Like, do you do ultra obscure stuff, you know, that people don't have any reference point or nostalgia or anything for? I just couldn't do it. I couldn't. At this point, it became like, I've got these other horror podcasts that have gigantic resources. They're either affiliated with Fangoria, they're affiliated with Dread Central or Bloody Disgusting, and I can't compete with them. I simply can't because they have like a huge team. This is just me and producer Pete kicking it. You know, this is a mom and pop, couture, homemade type of sandwich comfort food. You know, there is no big podcast network behind it yet. Inquire within. So it becomes one of those things where I just got so frustrated because there was no way for me to level the playing field. I love all movies. I'm a cinephile. I love movies. I truly do. That's why I'm here. It just got to a point where everybody's doing the same shit. And I was like, nah, I have to pivot. And this season is the pivot. This is where we go from being more of a horror genre podcast. Still shit tons of genre. This is all genre movies, it's, you know, all kinds of stuff. But this is the pivot where we go on to take over all of Hollywood. I'm going to come through. I'm going to crush that sign like Godzilla. And we're going to explore some of the biggest chances, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that, you know, Hollywood, big studios sunk into these movies. Some worked, some didn't. I want to implore you to give this season more of a shot. There's going to be movies that you're going to be like, did he really just do an episode on that movie? But I want you to come on this journey because there is an overarching narrative throughout. There is a through line to this entire season. And I'm so happy to be back. I'm so happy to be here with you. Thank you. Follow me on social media. Tell people about the show. Write a review. Get involved. I want to learn from you as much as you learn from me on this podcast. I want you to go to Apple Podcasts. Go to the review section, okay? Send me a fact or a fun little piece of trivia, something that's going to stump me. I want you to stump me. If you do so, I will read it on air. Guys, listen, y'all be in my DMs telling me how much you love the show. Now it's time to put that love on Front Street. And the best way for you to do that is go write a review. I'll read it on air. And let's get that positivity. Let's get the conversation going. Let's do this. Let's make it happen. This is The Offering Season 3, and we are not playing games. So without any further ado, because God damn it, you've been waiting so long for a new season, we got to get into it. We gotta. Let's get in the time machine, the proverbial DeLorean, if you will, and let's go back to 1986. ...1985 is an absolute global juggernaut year for Sylvester Stallone. He does Rambo First Blood Part 2, which is like an international sensation. Sometimes you undersell the fact of just how big some of these American movie stars were on a global level. This is pre-internet, this is pre-any kind of connection that the, you know, we're all tapped in now, as opposed to how things were in 1985. It's iconic. It's an iconic movie. And then he's got the 1-2 rope-a-dope punch with Rocky IV, which was like the biggest Rocky movie to date, which is crazy to imagine. And this guy won an Academy Award, you know, for the first movie, and the sequels were big too, but the fourth one. So right now, in 1985, going into 1986, Sylvester Stallone is the biggest star in the world. Like, he's box office. He's at the point in his career where he can write a blank check. And that's like, that's the ultimate, that's what every artist wants to get to. You've made money for other people, you've made money for producers, for a studio, and they're like, what do you want to do? And this is what he did. This was the follow-up. Cobra, 1986, was the follow-up.
Society is breeding a new kind of criminal. It's also breeding a new kind of cop. Meet Cobra. He does the job nobody wants.
Did you use unnecessary deadly force?
I used everything I had.
Do you know you have an attitude problem?
Yeah, but it's just a little one. You think you would recognize me if you saw him again?
The tall one?
Yeah. The one that wants to kill you.
Do what you have to do to get a lead on this maniac.
And if I find him?
Do what you do best.
Stallone is Cobra, the strong arm of the law.
Recently, Netflix released a documentary called Arnold. It's fantastic. It's three parts. Definitely watch it. But it's the first real time, other than some of the Expendables junkets, where we've gotten into it, how much Schwarzenegger and Stallone were really, really just rivals. They hated each other. You know, there was a friendly competition, but I think Stallone, you know, in this documentary shows his cards. And he's like, man, he's like Schwarzenegger. And he even said, and I love Stallone for this and I appreciate him for this. He's like, Schwarzenegger's a better actor. He's more charismatic. He's a bigger star than I ever was. And that's big, especially from these guys who, this is about ego. You know, this is about machismo. This is a dick measuring contest. And that is what the 80s rivalry between these two men is about. Schwarzenegger, let's just go back in time. He's kind of like just starting to find it. He does Conan the Destroyer in 84. That kind of sucked. The Terminator is the breakout role in 84. And then he does Red Sonja because he was contractually obligated. And that stars Brigitte Nielsen as Red Sonja. That'll come into play later. And then he does Commando and Raw Deal. Commando was a big hit. Raw Deal was not. It made money. Like, it made money, but it's not making Rambo money. Schwarzenegger doesn't heat up. Where he takes the lead from Stallone is 87. In 87, you've got The Running Man and Predator, and that's his 1-2 knockout punch to the box office. So this is kind of the point where Stallone is either going to keep the momentum he has, or he's going to get out. I don't know sports stuff. So he's not going to do good. It's like when the guy throws the ball and he's out. Yeah, he's out. So if he, you know, it's hard to keep that momentum, especially with two iconic roles of John Rambo and Rocky Balboa. So, is Cobra a vanity project? Absolutely. This is where Stallone is powerful enough to basically make requests and tell the studio, tell producers. He can tell people to fuck right off. And he does many times throughout this movie. He doesn't care because he knows he's built up the cachet and the star power to do whatever the fuck he wants to do. He's confessed to it. Stallone has said he developed an ungodly ego in the mid-80s, which is only natural for a wealthy megastar who accumulated a large portion of his fortune during this decade of excess. So this is, you know, Stallone right now, he's forever etched and intertwined with that Reagan era of our great nation, for better or worse. So how about Beverly Hills Cop? No, this is not an Axel Foley podcast. Maybe we'll get there one day. Sylvester Stallone signed on to play the lead in Beverly Hills Cop. And Paramount was like, listen, this guy's hot. This guy, you know, they had Beverly Hills Cop in development. And this is prior. This is, I want to say Beverly Hills Cop is making the rounds by late 82. So you've got to follow me on this because we're jumping through the time spectrum here. But you're fine with that, right? Multiverse shit, Rick and Morty, you're up to speed. He says to Paramount, I'm going to rewrite this script. I'm going to completely change it. I'm going to take out a lot of the humor. The comedic aspects are going to be gone. And he turns it into an action movie. And then he felt it was better suited for him. So Paramount was like, they're looking at this script. They're like, you added all these action sequences. It drove the estimated budget up by $24 million. And in 1983-84 money, that's big money. We're talking about close to a $60 million project before marketing, before anybody's gotten paid. That's just production alone. And that's a lot of money at that point to spend on a movie. You know, is where you look at things now and they're spending $300 million just on the movie. And then the marketing is another $300. Stallone walks out of Paramount. He basically leaves them holding the bag. And this fucked up studio dealings for a hot minute, this whole Beverly Hills Cop nonsense. Nobody wanted to trust Stallone. Everybody was like, dude, he had this whole thing in development and he just walked away from it. Now, Paramount, smartly, they were able to pivot and they got Eddie Murphy on board and the rest is history. Beverly Hills Cop it's an absolute 80s classic. Sometimes things are serendipitous and they work out and they make sense. They happen for the right reason. You got to believe in yourself. You got to believe in a higher power. And it worked out for old Eddie Murphy. What happens with Paramount is why Stallone does over the top with Cannon, because largely what Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus tell him, they're just like, hey, listen, you do whatever you want. Like, we believe in you as a star, you know, whatever you need. And that's what Cannon was trying to do at that point. Cannon was really, like, they had Chuck Norris, they had Charles Bronson, they later Van Damme, and they were trying to build, like, an old-school studio system of stars. And that's admirable. Like, it makes sense. That's what Warner Brothers did. You know, that's a part of this business. Paramount's loss, however, was Cannon's gain. They exclusively dealt with mostly bargain basement screenplays. Golden and Globus were more than happy to let Stallone have his way. They offered him unprecedented fees in what was a creative and financial no-brainer. They threw money. That was their solution. Whatever Stallone wants, you know? If he made $5 million for this movie, we're going to give him $10 million because it's a way to have a bankable star in your stable. It was in light of events that the kitsch extravaganza Cobra comes to fruition. Menachem wanted a star. He wanted a big star. He was willing to pay Sly whatever it took to do business with him. Now, he puts up the money. Golden Globus put up the money. It's not technically a Cannon picture. Warner Brothers distributed it, but they'd allowed Cannon. I mean, they spent all the money. But Warner Brothers is doing the distro, and they're trying to control it, you know. And it's crazy because they put up all this cash for this movie, but they're only allowed to have their name at the beginning and at the end, the Cannon Group, obviously. That was a little bit of a, I don't know how I feel about that. It's fine. They just didn't have that global, look, Cannon was huge, but they didn't have the infrastructure like Warner Brothers did. They didn't have those deals in place in a global sense. An agreement that would later see the likes of MGM and 20th Century Fox follow suit with the Cannon movies, where they're like, God damn, these ninja movies are making a lot of money, American Ninja in particular. It's crazy because Cannon is like this independent, you know, powerhouse, and they're distributing movies through MGM. They're distributing movies. They had a partnership with them. Now MGM, which was bought later by Amazon, they own the Cannon library. Most of the movies, like if Amazon wanted to do, Jesus Christ, don't threaten us with an over-the-top remake, but if they wanted to, they could. They own it. The Warner Brothers stamp of approval at that point could only help Cannon's reputation in the eyes of a more conventional mainstream audience. If anything, Cobra was going to be the movie that was going to make Cannon legit. It wasn't just a martial arts action movie with Chuck that was like, you know, $3 million to make. It wasn't Charles Bronson exploitive Death Wish sequels. This was the biggest star in the world. It's like apples to oranges. You're going from kind of these low budget, exploitive, sleazy action films to having like, there's no comparison. I don't even know if something like that could happen today. I mean, if the likes of an aging Bronson and a strictly small-time headliner, like such as Norris, could generate double and 20 times their budgets, respectively, just imagine the amount of bacon that someone like Sly, at this point in his career, could make for them. But what Cannon never realized was, more is more. The more money you spend, there's a chance you're going to lose a lot more money. I think if they had just stuck to the oceans and rivers that they knew and didn't go chasing waterfalls, they probably would have not. They would probably still be in business today, which would have been a beautiful thing. With Sly as their marquee attraction, Cannon was poised to become a major studio force to be reckoned with. And there was a lot of racism, especially for these guys who came from Israel. People looked at them as carpetbaggers, very shrewd. They didn't understand there was that disconnect between the regular American Hollywood studio executive and somebody like Menachem. Menachem was, he was a wheeler, a dealer. He always tried to shoot straight unless it was paying people that he owed money, because he was pretty slick about that. Allegedly, Stallone was paid $10 million by Cannon for Cobra, and $12 million for Over the Top as an added bonus. He also had creative control, which is like insane. You, again, these are things like you wouldn't make Spider-Man 4 now with Tom Holland and be like, yeah, Tom, you can write the script too. And you can do this because look, I mean, if Tom Holland, you know, was successful, this happens. This does happen where people get power, but no one on these big mega budget movies. We kind of saw that this year with Fast X. You can feel with Fast X the absence of Justin Lin. And then it's like, oh, this is Vin Diesel. Vin Diesel is running the show now. Like, yeah, they hired director Louis Leterrier, but is it really Leterrier's movie or is it Vin's movie? And it feels so stupid and dumb that it feels more like Vin's movie. And I think that was the relationship that Cosmatos, George Cosmatos, the director of Rambo and Cobra, I think Stallone could bully him. And that's kind of been the rumor that he did bully him. We'll get into that. This film was loosely, and I can only use loosely, please put the emphasis on that word, based on a novel called A Running Duck by Paula Gosling, which was later filmed under the title Fair Game in 1995 with Cindy Crawford and William Baldwin as your star. You know, it was still the 90s. We were still trying to get other Baldwin brothers over. Like, we were trying to, like, hey, you know, Alec made a lot of money. He just did The Shadow. Let's, you know. Like, and it's also Fair Game, which is funny, too, is this is 86. And then, like, 9 years later, is that nine? It's 8 years later. No, it's nine. It's 9 years later. Listen, you came here for movie talk. You didn't come here for fucking math, all right? Like, I'm not going to help you with your homework. You can pay better people for that. Cindy Crawford was a huge supermodel at the time, and that was the height of culture. She was the standard of beauty. She was beautiful. She's iconic. I think if she had a little more personality and acting ability, she could have been like a Marilyn Monroe. They spent a lot of money on that Fair Game movie. They lost a lot of money, too. It's a bad movie. I mean, look, it's fine, but Fair Game has really nothing to do with A Running Duck at all. There's pieces and concepts within the novel that become that movie, but it's largely its own thing. I got to talk about Fair Game just for a second. Cindy Crawford's husband, she's going through a terrible divorce, and her husband is involved with a dealings with a KGB agent. It's ridiculous. It is the most ridiculous mid-90s movie. It's not a good movie. Should you watch it? Yes. Yes, you should watch it because it's a star vehicle, and both of these people are like triple platinum wood. They're just terrible. Baldwin's terrible. She's terrible. But you know what? They're sexy. And in 1995, that was enough. Because, listen, this is how studio executives think. Basically, what Hollywood films, especially when you have the hetero thing happening, it's, will these people fuck? That is what the assumption, that's how they make these movies. They're like, you know, like you have a male and a female lead, and it's like, will they sleep together? Would people want to see them fuck? That's what a lot of, you know, they do like the screen tests. If there's a believable chemistry between these two people, we can sell this movie. Honestly, I would have rather seen a leaked porn tape of Cindy Crawford and William Baldwin than Fair Game, but it is what it is. Yeah, so Stallone offers author, I just want to make sure that I have her name, Paula Gosling, because now we're talking about Ryan Gosling. I'm getting hot under the collar. Whew, he's a hunk. the book, A Running Duck, has very little to do with Gosling's book. Do you get what I'm saying? This adaptation it's funny because she's had this book out, and every time they've tried to adapt it into a movie, it has nothing to do with the book. It's like barely, you know, like they add a shark. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. So Stallone, again, ego, hubris, whatever. Stallone offers Gosling to rewrite her book with his name on it. He's like, I'm going to rewrite the book, and, you know, put my name on it. It'll sell better that way. And she was like, absolutely not. You're... You're crazy. And he haunted her about this because when Stallone finds a project he wants to work on, he will do everything in his power to make it happen. You got to respect that gumption. You got to respect that dedication to craft. So the novel Fair Game by Paula Gosling, in, all in quotations here, it was cited as source material just enough. Like there was just enough elements that she would receive a screen credit. Contractually, they had to do that. But what this script that Stallone writes, because he did write the screenplay, it's an amalgamation of Gosling's novel and Stallone's version of Beverly Hills Cop. And then he introduces wholly new and original elements. This is what I always tell producer Pete. I'm like, a bad idea never dies. Like, if you have a good idea, this is Michael Eisner, ran Disney. This is what he said, and ran a bunch of studios. He's like, if you have a good idea for a movie, it's never dead. It's just waiting to be made. And I agree with that. You know, a good idea can never die. So if you're inspired and you're out there, you're writing your own screenplay, you're making your own movie, you're making anime, whatever you're doing, never let that die. Keep that in your pocket. So in the end, screenplay by Sylvester Stallone. So Stallone was dead set on making Cobra his version of Dirty Harry, which I think is funny because obviously Clint Eastwood was a huge player, worked damn near 50 years with Warner Brothers, and he comes back the next year after this movie and makes the Deadpool. So there's a rumor that Clint saw Cobra and he's like, I can still do it better than this kid. That's my terrible Clint Eastwood impression. Stallone was absolutely a menacing mogul at this point, and he had his mind dead set on certain things with Cobra. Getting Brigitte Nielsen, which was Stallone's then wife, who he had met filming Rocky IV, was cast as Ingrid Knudsen, that is a terrible name, as the female lead. Basically, this was the whole deal with Cannon and with Warner Brothers later. If Stallone didn't get Brigitte Nielsen in the movie, he wasn't going to make the movie. This is absolutely crazy. So you've got this product. It's terrible. It's art, whatever. You've got this. He's amalgamated a novel, Beverly Hills Cop. He's got the script. They want to make the movie. And then he's like, yeah, I'll make it, but she's got to be the lead. It's like, Jesus Christ, dude, the cojones on this guy. Like, this movie is in pre-production. We're getting ready to shoot it. This is it. Like, it's my wife. I'm in love with her. And it was weird. The whole relationship between Brigitte Nielsen and Sylvester Stallone is weird. It's a whirlwind romance. You know, they meet on Rocky IV. It doesn't last long. The marriage lasts a couple of years and it's done. But I think part of it was, you know, you're in love with a woman. Maybe you're in lust. You marry her. I don't know. And she's like, hey, I want you to further my acting career. And that becomes, you know, the tit for tat. So it is what it is. Yeah, you know, I like cheekbones. Golan and Globus catered to Stallone's every whim. This was the summer of love for Cannon and Stallone. Cannon's newly minted star would be catered to hand and foot, whatever he wanted. Now, originally, as you know, the film Cobra takes place during Christmas, and it was supposed to be filmed in Seattle, climaxing with a motorcycle chase scene on a ferry between the islands. Even though everything was prepared to start filming, the final theatrical version of the scene at night, that chase sequence, Stallone demanded that the ending to this movie be changed because of the mosquito problem at that time, which would have made the nighttime filming very difficult to endure. So the reason they didn't shoot in Seattle was Stallone doesn't like mosquitoes. Yeah, they largely shot it around Los Angeles then because Stallone also liked the warm weather. This is before he discovers Miami and makes The Specialist. We'll talk about that later. Stallone's early draft of the script contained many differences from later drafts in the final film. These include, but not limited to, the opening shootout, taking place in a movie theater. And Warner Brothers said, fuck right off, you cannot open this movie with a shooting in a movie theater. It was supposed to be a meta commentary on all these action pictures. They're like, you're not going to do this. So he's like, oh, do it in a grocery store. Which later is aped by the film with Brian Bosworth, Stone Cold, which kind of has the same cold open, but it's far more campy and extreme than Cobra. Cobra mentions in this original script how he had a girlfriend who was killed by a psychopath he was trying to catch. And that was originally what the impetus of this movie was going to be, that his girlfriend is murdered by this cult and now he's chasing them. They took the girlfriend thing out because Brigitte Nielsen didn't like it. She's like, well, you know, she's like, I want to be the only love interest. I want to be the focal point as the female lead.
So I cut it out. You know, Brigitte, I'll do what I can. I'll cut the movie. You know, I'll make sure that you get all the shine.
An additional big nighttime action sequence on a boat where Cobra and Ingrid are hiding and attacked by the Night Slashers cult members, with Cobra and his partner Gonzalez managing to kill all of them. That was a whole sequence that got cut because the film was just ballooning out of control. And they're like, we can't afford another $5 million action sequence. So they cut that. And there was a different ending, which it's revealed that Monty was the actual leader of the New World cult. And when he tries to kill Ingrid, he's shot and killed by Cobra. So his partner in this movie, that was going to be their big twist ending. They ended up not shooting it because they realized this is ridiculous. It's what we call in pro wrestling hotshot booking, where you're like, we need a solution to this storyline. What could the solution be? Oh, he's the bad guy. And it's just like, no, there's nothing here that indicates or is indicative that this guy would be the villain. But now we're going to get to my favorite part. Ego.
We'll be right back with more of The Offering with Jerry Horror.
Where can I get my pickles when I can't get to a farmer's market or festival? The answer is Pickle Island in Bayville, New York. Listen, I've been selling a small pickle my whole life. I know all about it. From the vine to the brine, they keep their pickles cold with a delicious, diverse selection of gourmet pickles, including their savory, classic bread and butter sweet chip, horseradish pickle, jalapeno pickle, and sweet Cajun pickle. They even got pickled beets and okra, a variety of sour treats for your next barbecue or get-together. But if you visit their store in Bayville, Long Island, New York, there's so much more. A fantastic selection of physical media, comics, music, movies, VHS, and Matt Roran, their enthusiastic pickle salesman. It's kind of a big deal. Check them out now at HormansBestPickles.com. Hey, quit jerking your gherkin and head over to Pickle Island in Bayville, New York. Insomniacs, join the chat monsters and fellow miscreants of the Midnight Hour for the Gooligans YouTube live stream for a wild night flight of retro commercials, vintage trailers, indie short films, horror comedy, weird music videos, and featuring the occasional Matt Roran appearances. Horror hosted by your favorite funny monsters, the Gooligans, as they stream a live online visual arts magazine and variety television show of the likes rarely ever seen, while also hosting live chat-along viewings of such other horror classic films like Carnival of Souls, House on Haunted Hill, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, The Werewolf of Washington, and one of my favorites, Manos, The Hands of Fate. This is late night television the way you remembered. Subscribe to the Gooligans YouTube channel and make sure to click on that notification bell so that you won't miss the next Gooligans YouTube live stream. Listeners and fans of The Offering can get their hands on their very own The Offering with Jerry Horror merch, now only at TeePublic. Find your own fresh The Offering with Jerry Horror high-quality merchandise, including t-shirts, hoodies, tank tops, long sleeves, stickers, and mugs. Just like the show, we've got gear that's mostly horror, always genre. The Offering with Jerry Horror TeePublic store has everything you need to represent your favorite podcast. Folks, head on over to teepublic.com right now and pick up your very own Offering tee today. You're listening to The Offering with Jerry Horror. Got a question or a story you want to share with me? It might be featured in a future episode. Email me at jerryhorror@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter @jerryhorror. I'm also on Instagram. You can find me there @jerryhorror. Rate and review this show on Apple Podcast, and you might find your review in an upcoming episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to The Offering. Now back to the show. The supporting cast and extras, and this is, look, you can go buy, Shout Factory has a great Blu-ray right now. It's been remastered in 2K. It looks great. The film grain's there. Definitely pick it up. Get it cheap on Amazon. Basically, the supporting cast, people have gone on record, the supporting cast, extras, crew hands, anybody, grips, lighting, they were forbidden to talk to Sylvester Stallone during this movie. There was an incident where one of the grips was trying to talk to Stallone about something, and they fired him. They fired him right off the movie because you were told. Cosmatos could talk to him, Brigitte could talk to him, the producers could talk to him, but anybody else, anybody, catering, don't fucking talk to Stallone. That was the mandate on this set. Hey, look, man, I don't know, dude. I don't know, but that usually, maybe he's a genius. Maybe he's like, oh, well, I'm in character and I don't want to break the Cobra character. That could have been it. Or my theory, he was just out of control at this point. This is the height of Stallone's mogul. Like, this is just where, like, he can do whatever he wants. He could have told them he wanted to make a fucking Benji movie. And they would have been like, sure, you can make a Benji movie. At one point during filming, and I've spoke to a couple of people about this. I can't say who. At one point during filming, Stallone complained to legendary cinematographer Rick Waite. He's shot everything. He's made so many great movies. He's shot so many great movies. That they were falling behind and needed to push his crew to work harder. He said to Rick Waite, he said, listen, you need to pull your crew together because this is not working the way that I want it to be working. Waite responded to Stallone one day very angrily, and he got right in Stallone's face and even pushed him. He said, listen, the reason we're having so many delays here is because you're fooling around with Brigitte and showing off your bodyguards. You're basically coming here to the set playing the role, and we're all working hard, but you're so caught up in your own bullshit that you're making this movie a lot harder to make. And from all accounts, this is the moment that there was a little bit of course correction where it was like, yo, this guy, Rick Waite, had the balls. He's like, fuck it. I don't care who you are. Like, you're fucking up this movie. This wasn't like a deal where he's like, oh, you know, they talked in private. Like, he did this to kind of humiliate him and be like, all right, you're a tough guy, whatever. You're holding up this entire production with your bullshit. And that became a thing because this movie went way over budget and it ended up going like extra month of production because of Stallone's star shenanigans. It was one of the deals where Stallone's usually very hands-on creative. He's a writer, he's a director, he understands the process. But with this movie, and it's a point of contention, but I believe it at this point, he pushed Cosmatos around. Stallone, and this is not the first time, this happened on Rambo 3, this happened on a lot of movies, supposedly on Demolition Man, supposedly on Judge Dredd, where he would hire these directors because, you know, there was like DGA rules, Directors Guild, that he couldn't, you know, act and direct and do certain rules that were in place. So what he would do is he would get these guys, especially like Cosmatos, and push them around. What happened on this film was when Stallone was on set, Cosmatos was nice to everybody. And as soon as Stallone would disappear, being so frustrated by having to deal with Sly all day, Cosmatos would become a nightmare to work with because he was like a tyrant. He was like, Jesus Christ, I've been bullied all day by Stallone, so I'm going to take it out on everybody. Stallone was shocked that somebody would talk to him that way. And, yo, for all intents and purposes, he cleaned up his act and he behaved more professionally after this incident with Rick Waite. Although, he returned to his old egocentric behavior a few weeks later. Waite later said in an interview, despite his huge ego, Stallone did have a great sense of humor. He said that Cosmatos would have made a great producer, but he was a terrible director. And I was kind of throwing some shade there. You know, this is up to you. This is up to time. There's different reports. I believe that Stallone pushed these guys around because his ego, everything that was going on at the time, he was able to manipulate these directors to get what he wanted, and in some cases, bullying them. I think so. I think that's what happened. This isn't like, well, one person said this. This is a lot of people have come forward during the making of this film, co-stars, just everybody who worked on this movie. So it's not like, oh, I'm making this up, or I got this one guy was pissed off and this is the story of one dude. This is across the board. People just said Stallone, this movie was a nightmare to make because of Stallone's ego. Everyone always talks about the car in Cobra. It is a custom 1950 Mercury driven by Cobretti. His car was actually owned by Sylvester Stallone. It's got this great retro look. It's a rare vehicle. The studio used stunt doubles of the car for use in some of the action sequences, such as the jump from the second floor of the parking garage. That was pretty crazy. So they had all these doubles of the car. The production built three Cobra cars just for stunt work. Although they were identical on the outside, the moving parts were designed for specific sequences involving high-speed swipes and drifting with other vehicles, 180-degree turns, and even a few 360 spins. There's a lot of you that are nerds out there, and you want to, like, how come Cherry didn't talk about it? Stallone just released a Cobra action figure, and everything about this movie, like, he's got the cool car, he's got the custom gun. The gun itself is a Colt Gold Cup National Match 1911, chambered in a 9mm. The 9mm variant was made specifically for the film. Speaking of made specifically for the film, the knife used by the Night Slasher was made by knife designer Herman Schneider. Stallone asked Schneider to create a knife that audiences would never forget. And that's the knife that the titular villain, the Night Slasher, uses. By all accounts, that knife was super sharp. They had different versions of it. You know, they had a close-up knife, and that was the one. The close-up knife was the one that was the sharpest. And from what I understand, everybody got cut with that knife by accident. This is kind of weird. This is like, yo, listen. Since the 1970s, product placement had always been in movies, but there were people like Pepsi. Pepsi wanted to, they were like, we love Stallone. And they were doing like the Pepsi Challenge at the time. They were, you know, they had Michael Jackson. They were trying to be like the youth-oriented thing. So Stallone was cool. So they paid a big piece of the budget just to have their product in there. Obviously, he takes a swig of the Coors in the opening cold sequence. Coors was a sponsor. Toys R Us, it's got that great Christmas commercial with the Jeffrey Giraffe's family. So shrewdly, Stallone was very smart with this. And again, this comes the business acumen. He's like, he's selling ad space. And this becomes more predominant. We see this, you know, whether it's like, I think it was like Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, a Mountain Dew machine turns into a Transformer. Yeah, who wants that one? Hey, what does he turn into? A soda machine. What's his powers? He can give you diabetes. This is the wildest fact about this movie, which still blows my mind. Stan Bush's song, The Touch, which was heard in Transformers the movie in 1986, same year, and then incidentally, obviously, performed by Marky Mark Wahlberg in Boogie Nights, it was originally written for Cobra. The Touch, Stan Bush's the song The Touch, was supposed to be the closing credits, and it's kind of like, man, Stallone wasn't, he was like, I really don't like this song, Stan. I'm not really a fan. I'm not feeling it, you know? And I know music. My brother Frank, he's, you know, he makes music too. I know about music. It's one of those things where it's like Stallone's loss is Transformers gain. And then even like 20 years after, not even 20, like another decade later, it's Boogie Nights gain. The Touch is, it's iconic. We need to get into this because this is weird. I was talking to producer Pete about this before. The MPAA did not give a fuck about Rambo First Blood Part 2. Like, yeah, you're killing those minorities. Who gives a fuck? Like, we don't care. It's kind of like the whole thing with Marvel movies now where like, yeah, you can totally kill and murder things as long as they're not human. You know, it's like when you watch Avengers. Really the big impetus, like where they're fighting these nameless creatures that are not really human. So that's kind of the rule now in Hollywood. You can kill things as long as there is no human characteristics. And it even, look, I hate to say it, we're bringing up Fast X again. I'm so sorry. The villains in Fast X, there are a lot of fucking henchmen. It's almost like a video game where there's like the NPCs who are just like these like soldiers. A lot of Hollywood productions do this because you can have the same stunt team. And it's like they're ninjas. If you cover a guy's face and you put him in a costume, you can keep reusing him. He can be another bad guy in another scene. So it's like in Fast X, they're killing all these guys that are just like randos. And it makes no fucking sense. Like, I guess because
these guys in this big body armor and stuff, they're not seen as technically quote unquote human. They're just, they're meat shields. They're fodder to be murdered. Cobra was so hyper violent that it got an X rating from the MPAA, not once, not twice, but three times this movie got an X rating. Every time, like, they would give it back to Cosmatos and Stallone, and be like, we cut the movie down again, you give it an X rating. Because what was the difference between this and Rambo? You're killing Americans, it's on home soil, you can't do that, Sly. This is the part where we get into, is Cobra a slasher movie? And the answer is, kind of. Because if you watch what the Night Slasher and the cult are doing in this movie, especially in the beginning, it's very baked in. You can feel the slasher influence. You can feel the Friday the 13th of it all. And if you watch those scenes again, pay a little bit more attention because they cut them. I was even saying to Pete before, you could see the body of the girl they kill in the beginning, and it's in the morgue, and it's just a gruesome, gory, nasty, murdered body. And they had these great kill scenes, but the MPAA was like, nah. Even Warner Brothers saw it, and they're like, listen, man, you've got a lot of gore in this movie. You got some really gruesome kills in the first 10, 15 minutes. There were things like, even in the grocery store, like, I think now I counted by the rhythm, there's like five bullets that go into that guy in the beginning. It was more outlandish before those X-rated cuts. It was like he shot him like 12 times. I don't think a 9mm can hold 12 bullets or whatever it is, but Stallone made it happen. He's magic. Now we have to get back to this really quickly. Now this is technically a canon film. Warner Brothers distribution, blah, 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 blah. And as per Warner Brothers demand, their logo would grace the beginning and Canon's logo would be at the end. And they basically said, we won't distribute it if we can't do that. They've got so much money. Golden Globus, they've got so much money tied up in this movie. They're just stuck. Like, whatever Warner Brothers wanted, they have to do it because they're in business with them now. They're, you know, they're a partner. Now, allegedly, and I don't even think this is allegedly, this is pretty much fact at this point. The first cut of Cobra was 2 hours and 15 minutes. The movie stands now, it's like barely 90, it's 86 minutes, which is like perfect. Once Warner Brothers, they get the film into their hands, they see this and they're like, this is, you can't put this out. Like, this is supposed to be our summer blockbuster. And it's full of gore, it's full of sex, it's an unrepentant movie that's incredibly violent and probably off-putting and repugnant to most mainstream audiences, even though this was the flavor of the day. They said, listen, you gotta cut this movie down. And then something happened. A little movie that would go on to be called Top Gun with Tom Cruise, people had started to see it, and that was a Paramount movie. They basically said, this was even before Top Gun was done, they picked the date specifically to open against Cobra because they wanted to fuck Stallone because of the whole Beverly Hills Cop thing. So they're like, we're going to open Top Gun same day. And Warner Brothers, again, we're getting back into the dick measuring contest that was Hollywood in the 1980s. Fuck you, we're not moving the date. We're going to release Cobra on the same day. We're going to go head to head. So somebody in Warner Brothers at the time was like, listen, this is what we're going to do. This movie is a fat pig at 2 hours and 15 minutes. Chop it down. They brought in some of the best editors in the game to doctor this movie. And the whole rationale behind it was Top Gun has the 2 hour plus running time. It needs time to tell that story. It's more appropriate. But the thinking at Warner's was if we cut it down to 86 minutes, in the time that they show, you know, one screening of Top Gun, we can get two screenings of Cobra in and make more money. And that was what this was all about. Now, Cobra has the distinction of being the widest opening for a Warner Brothers release at the time. How wide was wide? Well, just to give you an example, going back to Fast X. Fast X opened on 4,000 screens. That was this year, the year of our Lord, 2023. Cobra opened, because obviously there were less people, the population was smaller, 2,131 screens. Cobra, this is the widest opening they've ever done. And shockingly, it beats Top Gun at the box office. Because what happened was Top Gun has legs. Top Gun was a word of mouth. It was really Tom Cruise. Like, he had been in movies like Risky Business, All the Right Moves, but this was his big coming out movie. And they forced Cruise to go head to head with Stallone. And it had nothing to do with the two stars. It was basically just Paramount trying to get their revenge on Stallone because of the Beverly Hills Cop debacle. This Cobra opened number one on Memorial Day weekend, 1986, with a debut of $15.7 million. Just for reference, now, like, you look at something like Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, the Miles Morales movie, the Thursday night previews had a $15 million, you know, so you just think, like, that was their whole weekend. You know, it was a lot less money in play, but it was big money at that time. Eventually, Cobra goes on to gross $160 million, which was six times its estimated $25 million budget. Now, according to the New York Times, this film was still considered a disappointment because its $48 million box office that it did in the U.S., it didn't live up to the success of Rambo, which did like $300 million globally, but it did like $100 million in the U.S., which was like, that was like crazy. Now they do, you know, $100 plus million. Again, Spider-Verse did close to almost $120 million opening weekend. So, you know, I mean, obviously it's inflation. We can't compare. So, yeah, it does $48 million at the box office. And then, because of word of mouth, it was the moment, it was the time, Top Gun went on to make $357 million globally that summer, which obviously $57 million over Rambo is like, so Paramount, like, they, you know, they were happy with themselves. Now, Reagan, who used, you know, and Stallone was noted Republican, as Schwarzenegger, both Republicans at that point. Ronald Reagan loved Rambo. Like, Rambo was like one of his favorite movies. Like, Donald Trump later would love Bloodsport. He watched Rambo a lot, like an unhealthy amount. I'm not quite sure what that was all about, you know, whatever. Hey, look, Rambo's a great movie. It's a lot of fun. But there was a special Camp David screening on June 6th, 1986. And Stallone was flown out via Air Force One to Camp David and had to sit with Ronald Reagan and, I don't know, split a box of goobers and... I don't know that must have been a weird screening. Sly, I really loved your movie. It's a fantastic film. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, maybe Favored Nations. I don't know. What did President Reagan think? He loved it. He goes on record as saying, you know, Rambo's my favorite Sly. Rocky's a close second place, but I love that Cobra. I love that Cobra. President Reagan. Jesus Christ. Supposedly, he got cuckolded with Mr. T. Mr. T was tapping on Nancy Reagan. Hey, look, man, the 80s were wild. Wild, right? P.A. Baracus? Jesus. Okay. Awards. This film went on to, Cobra was an award-winning film. The awards were Razzie nominations, of course, which in that era became par for the course for Stallone. The Razzies, they fucking, anytime Stallone had, it was almost like the Razzies, like, what are we going to nominate this year? Oh, Stallone's got a film coming out. So they love dogging this guy, and it became personal after a while. Whilst his newly minted wife, Brigitte Nielsen, had a perfect 3-for-3 record at the Razzies. This has not been beat to this day for recognition in her films, beginning with Red Sonja, Rocky IV, and Cobra. 3 years in a row. It's the three-peat. Okay, so the Razzies, listen, let me explain the Razzies. It's kind of out of fashion now because now we all love movies. It's almost like an outdated concept even though they still exist. It's the Razzberries. It's the movies that were just terrible, that nobody liked. The biggest moment of the Razzies, kind of like when they hit their apex, is when Halle Berry, she won an Oscar for Monsters Ball. And then she goes and wins a Razzie the same year for Catwoman. And a lot of times it's very, not to be catty, but it becomes one of these things where nobody ever shows up for the Razzies. They're like, fuck you, how dare you? You know, you're shitting on my performance. Halle Berry showed up to that shit and she owned it. She's like, I got two awards this year, one Oscar, one Razzie. It's the best of both worlds. And hats off to her, man. That's a big, big look. What is the legacy of Cobra? We're going to get into some talk about that because some things have changed. Yeah. Director Nicholas Winding Refn is a huge fan of Cobra. Him and Reagan fucking love this movie. I would love to see that happen. In Refn's cult film Drive, the main character has a toothpick in his mouth in some scenes. This is Refn's homage to the opening scene with Stallone having a matchstick in his mouth. The main star of the film, Ryan Gosling, who we speaked about before, also said in an interview with Us Magazine that he is a huge fan of Stallone. He was a huge fan of Cobra, and that's why he borrowed his character's toothpick habit from Cobra. It was a huge, huge influence on this movie. Like, I could not connect the dots on that, but this is what I'm saying. Like, you make movies, you don't know who you're going to influence. You don't know how that's going to play out over the test of time. Stallone was interviewed in late 2019, and he still wants to revisit the Marion Cobretti character. He wants to do a Cobra TV series. And I get it. He just released an action figure. When I say an action figure, it's a premium format figure. It's a 12-inch figure that he released through the Sly Stallone shop. It's $300. It's got real leather gloves. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's a piece of art. I can't afford it. But hey, if you write those reviews, you like and subscribe, you follow me on social media, whatever it is you do, maybe I can afford one of those, you know, and we can have an unboxing. It'll be beautiful. It'll be beautiful. What did Stallone end up doing? Well, he was really hot to do this Cobra TV series with Netflix. And as the rivalry still continues to this day, they were more interested in picking up Schwarzenegger series FUBAR over the Cobra series. So these guys now, they're friends. They get along. They've developed this wonderful bond, and it's beautiful to see both of them so emotionally open now, all these years later. But the rivalry still is not over, because Netflix was like, well, we can do a 6-episode season of Cobra. We could work with Schwarzenegger and do this kind of, you know, spy thing. And they chose Arnold. And again, the year after this is when Arnold really blows up. What is Stallone doing now? What is he resurrecting at this point? Because nothing is ever dead. In 2023, no IP ever dies. It just doesn't. It's something can be a total flop and they'll resurrect it 5 years later, 2 years later. All of these companies, especially Disney, are just cannibalizing their library. They're doing, you know, all these remakes. They're going to run out of movies to remake in live action. Whereas, like, I would love it if Amazon went back and they just said, hey, we're going to remake all these canon movies. We're going to do a new American Ninja. We're going to do whatever it is, Invasion USA. We're going to remake it. Stallone, as of this recording, is now doing a cliffhanger sequel. And he's going to, you know, play the same character. But what they're trying to do with this new cliffhanger is, I forget the actor's name, they think this guy's going to be an action star. So he's kind of passionate, passing the torch, so to speak, in this movie. Well, it's fine, because it could change, you know? Yeah. But that's kind of his intention. So essentially what Stallone is looking to do with Cliffhanger 2, or whatever this cliffhanger reboot, soft reboot, sequel, reboot, quill, whatever the fuck it's going to be, is he's introducing this character of a son-in-law, and it's going to be Pauly Shore. Pauly Shore, Sylvester Stallone, Cliffhanger 2. I don't know what happens. I don't even want to. Let's not tempt fate. I'm tempting the movie gods to make this movie, but maybe they should. Long story short, he's making this movie. He's looking to pass the torch to a younger actor, you know, make a new action star. It never works. They try it every time. And what happens is the young guy always gets overshadowed by the old guy because the nostalgia is baked in. Just like this new Flash movie. You know that Ezra Miller is going to be overshadowed by Michael Keaton. Everybody loves Michael Keaton. We haven't seen him in 30 years. We're excited to see that. It never quite works out the way they want it to. Let's talk about Rotten Tomatoes really quick. Rotten Tomatoes is an aggregator, but I always have to look it up. I'm always curious to see, because there always seems to be a disparity between the critics and the audience. The current holdings of Cobra on Rotten Tomatoes is 18% critical rating and a 43% audience rating. Now, I know a lot of Stallone heads, a lot of my fellow Sly lovers out there, Sly lovers pizza. We love Cobra. Cobra's like a great movie. And what the fuck are you people smoking? Cobra's not an 18% movie. It's highly entertaining. It's an hour and 23 minutes long. It's a pleasure. We've had it playing on the Blu-ray. It goes by super quick, goes down super smooth. Warner's made a great decision by cutting it down to an hour and 23 minutes. That was the move right there, because I think if this film had been this bloated, more horror-centric kind of slasher movie, I don't think it would have worked. For all intents and purposes, ostensibly, they bought Sly. They didn't care what the vehicle was. They bought that star. And they were like, listen, this guy's huge. It'll make money. We're fine. So now, this season, on The Offering, Part 3, Chapter 3, we are introducing a new segment that I would like to call Unhinged Reviews. These are reviews from the internet that I find from various websites. And they are people who are either fans or haters of the movie. And let me read this. This is by Nick M. from the Shout Factory website. My boredom was the disease. This movie was the cure. Awesome action flick. And I just want to say, I have to, because I love this review so much. I'm going to read it again. I'm sorry. This is from February 7th. 2023. So this is not like, oh, this was written 20 years ago. This is an unhinged review from this year. My boredom was the disease. This movie was the cure. Awesome action flick from Sly when he was at his best. It checks all the boxes for a great 80s action flick. One, underground criminal organization that needs stopping? Check. Hard-boiled hero cop who doesn't play by the rules, but has a soft spot for the ladies and puppies? Check. The hero cop drives a sweet, non-department-issued muscle car? Check. Picture of a hissing cobra on the grips of the hero's gun? Check. And my final closing statement? Brigitte Nielsen, scantily clad and dancing with robots. Check, check, and checkmate, my friend. Wow. You know what? Here's the thing. As crazy as this is, Nick M., you are not wrong. This is a fantastic movie. The legacy of Cobra is I enjoy this movie. It's good. It's fun. It's breezy. I always talk about the merits of 90-minute movies. This is a perfect 90-minute movie. Throw it on. By the time you take a bathroom break or you make yourself a snack, it's almost over. You don't know, and you're on to the next thing. What are we going to watch next? I don't know. Commando. That's a good double feature, right? Everybody loves Commando. It's good. It's got Ray Don Chong. Whatever happened to her? Where's she been? What's she been doing? It's Tommy Chong's daughter. Who knew that? That's crazy. I'm just dispensing facts like a fucking Pez dispenser. Look, man, the moral of the story, to bring this all home and in closing, Sly's ego was out of control. And with that being said, with everything that was going on in the mid-80s, this is not a bad movie. We're going to get to some other movies this season that are so crazy, like absolutely bug nuts crazy. Like, this was a hit. This made money. It opened at number one. Top Gun eventually, you know, it's kind of like one of those things. I always go back to Heartbreak Ridge with Clint Eastwood, another Warner Brothers movie. And he's teaching these young soldiers about keeping pace. They're off on a mission and they all run. They've got all their gear and they run ahead of Clint Eastwood. And he's just jogging slowly. And that's about winning, you know, it's like winning the war versus winning the battle. And Top Gun ultimately won the battle for the box office in the summer of 1986. Top Gun is a cultural touchstone. You know, it went on, they made Top Gun Maverick all these years later. It's a fantastic movie. If you haven't seen it, get out. It's great. So Cobra's kind of a relic, whereas Top Gun is, there's all these movies that are like essential films of the 80s. Back to the Future, Beverly Hills Cop, which was originally a Stallone vehicle. Stallone made his impression with Rambo. And I think what happened was, especially at this point in his career, it was, do we want to see Stallone outside of Rocky Balboa and John Rambo? General audiences were willing to eat up those movies. I mean, you have 6 installments, now 9 if you count the Creed movies for the Rocky series. You have 5 installments in the Rambo franchise. That last one, Last Blood, it's entertaining. It's funny because that movie reminds me more of a canon movie than any of the shit that he's done. Full disclosure, he literally rips out a dude's heart like Kano in Mortal Kombat, and that's why Rambo Last Blood is amazing. Just for that, it's a ridiculous film. It feels a little bit more like a Taken movie with Rambo, like he goes down to Mexico. It doesn't even feel like yeah, it's the same character, but it just, I don't know, something was off. It didn't work. As of this recording, he's dropping Expendables 4. He's got Tulsa King. So Stallone's doing good. He's got a reality show with his daughters who are beautiful. But for some reason, I've noticed this. I'm not a foot guy, but they've all got huge feet. Which leads me to believe that Jennifer Flavin, Sylvester Stallone's wife, is part Sasquatch. Well, folks, it's about that time where old Jerry puts the matchstick in his mouth and hits the old dusty trails. This season's going to be a banger. I mean, this is one down, many more to go. But hey, season 3, man, you got to stay tuned for this season because it's going to get wild. I mean, super wild. Big swings, big misses, blockbusters, bloated budgets, and some of the craziest shit I've ever talked about in this podcast. We're going deep. We're doing some more recent movies. Hey, listen. Follow me on social media. I'm at Jerry Hara. I'm on Letterboxd. I'm on IG. I'm on Twitter. Write those reviews. I'll read them on air. You know, stump me. Give me a little something that, you know, trip me up. I like trivia. I like to have fun. You know, I like board games and shit. How come nobody ever invites me over to play them? I don't know. You know, last season I talked a lot about starting a Patreon. Fuck that. We're going to do an OnlyFans. You know, who knows? Might even have a cappuccino. I'm not sure. It's going to be crazy. It's always crazy. So, again, I hope that this episode finds you well. If you're going through it, somebody's going through it, call 988 because we got to keep that going. People have all kinds of issues. One issue that I don't have is making sure that I have an Irish goodbye. Out the door. No, I'm not going to do you like that because it's Jerry Hara. This has been The Offering. It's mostly horror, but always genre. And I love you. I'll see you soon. Good night and good luck. You've been listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. I'm very sorry. Produced by Pete Bune. If you have a question or a story you want to share with me, we'd love to hear from you. You can email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit us up at Twitter at Jerry Hara or on Instagram at Jerry Hara. You get in the picture? Subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are provided for you and your family. I want you to enjoy. Just join us next time for another offering.
This has been a Sick Boy Wolfgang production. Thank you for listening.